genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brain.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Oh, then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turning now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Every show has a theme, and today's theme is always be prepared. My first guest was a master organizer. She showed us how being organized improves our stress, our health, our confidence, our money with her simple PLACE system. My next guest is a noted historian and World War II expert. And for those of you who listen to the show regularly, you know Billy the Brain is a World War II nut. He's going to recount for us one of the most intense weeks in human history, the week leading up to World War II. In 1939, the last week of August was as intense and filled for Europe as the 10 days in October leading up to the Cuban Missile Crisis was for the United States. My guest will show how the British, and in particular Neville Chamberlain, were organized to try to stave off the start of war. If you want to join in the conversation, you can always call us at 639-0008. Richard Overy is a professor of modern history at King's College in London. He's writ extensively on modern German and European history. His latest book is titled 1939 Countdown to War. It recounts the days leading up to World War II. Welcome to the show, Richard. How are you today?
I'm fine.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. You're calling all the way from Great Britain, so thank you very much for that. I was excited about your book when I first saw that it was coming out. I've read it. I loved it. But I have to ask you, as a historian, you've got thousands of years from which to choose. How did you become interested in this period of time leading right up to World War II?
I think I've always been fascinated by historical drama, really. I think that in the world of the 1920s, 1930s, the Second World War, there's more drama packed into those 20 years than you'll find in almost any other 20 years in European history. And I think it's not just a drama. I think there are the big questions, very big questions that need answering, and I think that that's what's always attracted me, the idea of the big question.
Mm. Well, Richard, it's interesting that you would pick that week leading up to the beginning of World War II, because that is also one of the most researched weeks in history. A lot of people have done research and found materials on that. At this point, you know, hasn't it all been said? Is there any new or fresh material about this time of period that you're unearthing that kind of sheds more light on the time?
Yeah, I mean, we're doing that all the time. It's what historians do, of course. You root around in the archives, you look at things that people haven't looked at properly. For this book, there was quite a lot of material which I was able to find in the archive, which had not been properly used before. There are things that get overlooked. It depends what you're coming with. If you're coming with a set of ideas when you look at some archives, you think, well, that tells me this, this tells me that. But actually, you've got to be very open to what you find in the archive. And I think historians will go on finding things from this period.
Okay, well, now that's interesting. So you didn't go into this with any preconceived ideas. You were open to the material and sort of let it lead you where it led you. So the first question to ask about that last week of August in 1939 leading up to the invasion of Poland is this. Was the outbreak of war in 1939 inevitable?
Well, the outbreak of some kind of crisis was clearly going to happen. It had already happened. Japan had invaded China. There was war in Asia. There was crisis in Africa. Germany was expanding in Europe. It's difficult to imagine that at some point there wouldn't have been some kind of conflict. But that's a bit different from saying that it would have happened in September 1939. A lot of other things might have happened. I think the important thing to remember is that both sides desperately hoped that it wouldn't happen. Hitler hoped he could attack Poland, get away with it, not have to fight World War. Britain and France hoped that they could deter Hitler, that he would see how stupid it was to plunge Europe once again into a major war like 1914-18, and that at the very last moment he would give in. But neither of those things happened. But there were possibilities, and that's why this week, I think, is filled with a particular sense of drama. We're on the edge of something which might just have gone a different way.
And historians love to play that what-if game, and if time permits, I want to play that what-if game a little bit later. But, Richard, I'm going to hit the pause button here for just a second and rewind to what you just said, because most of us here in America find it interesting. When you said both sides didn't want it to happen and you cited Germany didn't want it to happen, most of us believe that Hitler was a megalomaniac, he was bent on world domination, but that was not the case, and that's what you bring out in your book, isn't it? Why do you think that's not true?
Well, I think Hitler is simply an opportunist. He doesn't know what he can get away with. What he wants to do is to establish Germany as a major power in Europe. He hopes that he can at some point dominate the Russian area and defeat Bolshevism. And I think the thing about Hitler is that he doesn't think systematically. He doesn't really have a plan. Everybody thought he had in 1945, 46 at Nuremberg. They tried to show that this conspiracy, this plan, that he and his lieutenants got together and worked it all out. But they didn't. Very few people influenced Hitler. Hitler had some pretty developed idea that he wanted to dominate Central and Eastern Europe, and at some point perhaps have a war with the Soviet Union. But world domination, war against Britain and France, war against the United States, not really on his agenda.
Now, I find that interesting. So the way you just described it there, it's almost as if you're portraying Hitler as a spoiled child. He's pushing the boundaries, testing to see what he can get away with. He's just annexed the Sudetenland. Neville Chamberlain went over there and pretty much gave away Czechoslovakia. We'll talk about that in just a minute, too. But he's testing. He's a child, and he's getting a sense for what he can get away with without thinking of the consequences, and certainly down the road he had no idea that he was going to plunge the world into war. Is that a fair assessment?
It's a very fair assessment. In fact, the analogy of a spoiled child, I think, is a very good one. And I think if you were a Freudian psychoanalyst, you'd take Hitler to the one side, put him on a couch, and try to find out what had gone wrong. He is like a spoiled child. After Czechoslovakia, after the Sudeten crisis in 1938, he doesn't have a war. He wants to have a war with the Czechs. He's incredibly angry that the British and French have obstructed him. He is like a child that's been told you can't do that. And I think that's what makes him dangerous, of course, in August 1939, because he doesn't want anybody to say to him again, don't do that. He wants to be the child that can get away with things. And for a long time, of course, he thinks he will get away with it. The British and French they're parents who've lost authority, if you like. But at the last minute, they do tell him, you can't do it, and they declare war on him.
Yes. Well, now, you paint an interesting picture here, Richard. By the way, we're talking to Richard Overy, everybody, whose book is 1939, Countdown to War. You paint an interesting picture. So here's Hitler. He's itching to fight a war. He wants to take over Eastern Europe, as you have said, and I find that's interesting. But I want to flip it to the other side of the coin, if I can, for just a minute, because most of us listening here in the United States don't really have a sense of what was going on in the mind of the average German during this time period, the guy on the street in Germany. What were ordinary citizens of Germany feeling about going to war? Because Hitler's keen on doing it, were they just as keen on fighting a war as Hitler was?
They certainly were not, no. And they certainly didn't want to wage a world war. Of course, the idea of the ordinary German is quite difficult, but if you think about the average German, he's pulled in two directions in the late 1930s. On the one hand, he's glad, of course, that Germany's kind of found its place in the world again, that they can hold their heads up, that Hitler is reinvigorating the nation. They like that. But on the other hand, they know he's running risks. They know that there's a possibility, perhaps, of a European war again. And, of course, they've all been through it, too. They suffered, like the British and the French, during the war. Many of them don't want another war. A quick war against Poland, well, they might get away with that. But the idea of a world war, it's quite interesting that the witnesses of the German population on the day that World War did break out, when Britain and France declared war, they say that in Berlin you could see it on the faces of the people. I mean, one of the best witnesses of this is, of course, the American journalist William Scherer, who was in Berlin on that day. And he said he wandered around the streets. Instead of looking at people glad that war's broken out, enthusiastic, waving flags, not at all, lots of depressed faces.
Well, and they had right to be depressed. So I guess we in the United States have this vision that Hitler had geared up Germany to fight this war, and they were all ready to march out. They were all little Hitler youth following him in his place. So I'm going to change gears here, Richard, for just a second. I'm going to ask you to bring this a little bit closer to home for your American cousins over on this side of the pond here. What role did the United States play in the week leading up to World War II, and why weren't we more involved?
Well, the United States played almost no role, in fact. Roosevelt sent an appeal about a week before the outbreak of war, asking everybody to seek peace and so on and so on. Nobody took any notice of it. The Germans pretended they hadn't even received it. Chamberlain didn't reply and instead sent a letter to Roosevelt urgently asking him to supply them with a northern bomb site. Roosevelt refused. I mean, it's quite interesting that for European statesmen, Roosevelt was a marginal figure in August 1939. And, of course, that's, in a sense, what Roosevelt had to live with, because the American public did not want to be involved in war, did not want to be involved in European affairs. There were opinion polls which showed Americans actually quite divided between whether they preferred Germany to Britain and France. Later on, of course, they sided very strongly, of course, with the democracies. But there was, a sense, I think, in the United States that this was a European squabble, and it wasn't something they should become involved in, while Hitler and Chamberlain simply thought that it was nothing to do with the United States. It would be impertinent if the United States intervened.
Ouch. Oh, that hurts us now that we've become a world power, Richard Overy. Yeah. That kills us to hear that. But it is very interesting. We were a house divided. I mean, on the one hand, we were actually having they were at that time Nazi rallies in Madison Square Garden supporting the Nazi cause and what they were doing. We had pacifists like Charles Lindbergh who was saying, they're going to kick our butt if we go into war. So it was an interesting time in America, and it's also interesting to find out that we were marginalized in world politics at that time. We've got to take a real short break here, Richard, to do some business and some commercials. But when we come back off of the break, I would like to ask you about Neville Chamberlain himself. He's sort of gotten a bad rap in history. And I want to talk to you about how you portray him in your latest book, 1939 Countdown to War. Don't answer that now. Answer it when we come back after this short break.
And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
It turns the brains into guacamole.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Bill Frank. You're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, AM 1400. We're positive talk radio for Ventura County. You can also hear us streaming over the internet at brainstormingonline.com. My special guest in this half hour is Richard Overy. His book is 1939, Countdown to War. And we are really examining just one week in history, or a short period of time in history, that led right up to the beginning of World War II. Before we get back to my guest, however, I do have another ice cream giveaway, and this will go out to the second caller that calls in at 639-0008, 639-0008. Call in. You can win a chance to win an ice cream cone or a cup of ice cream from McConnell's Fine Ice Cream on East Main Street here in Ventura, right at the corner of the Pacific View Mall. And that'll go to the second caller at 639-0008. Richard, now back to you. Your book, 1939, Countdown to War, to me, reading your book brought out an interesting perspective that most of the American histories recounting that period of time don't come out with, and that is your take on Neville Chamberlain. Neville Chamberlain, of course, was the PM, Prime Minister at that time. History has sort of given him a bad rap as an appeaser. In essence, he sold out the Czechs in what turned out to be an unsuccessful attempt to keep peace in Europe. Would Neville Chamberlain have sold out the Poles the same way he sold out the Czechs as we were getting closer to war if negotiations had broken out?
Well, he wouldn't have sold out the Poles. He was determined by then to stick by his obligation. Chamberlain has been misjudged. He did think that he could save the peace of Europe, and he was determined to, and he hated the idea of repeating a war. He'd seen what war was. He'd seen people whose children had been killed and maimed by the war. He could see the cost of the war to European societies, and it couldn't make sense for him that you should risk risk waging a Second World War again. So he wasn't just a feeble man. He was a man committed to the idea that major war is a bad thing. Now, I think that's a fairly noble ambition. He was faced with politicians like Mussolini and Hitler, but he couldn't understand. He couldn't gauge them. He didn't understand what drove them. And so he thought he could maintain links with them for longer than he could. But there came a critical moment, I think, in 1939, where he just finally realized that Hitler would not keep his word, that Hitler was not to be trusted, that Britain would have to arm to deter Hitler, if possible. That was his preference. But if not, there would have to come an awful moment where he would have to declare war. My view of Chamberlain really is that he's a man, actually, at that point, of some courage. He hated the idea of war. He hated what it would cost, and yet he was the one who in the end had to declare it. Not a light decision, not an easy decision to make for him, but he did make it.
No, it wasn't, but history does sort of paint him as being a very feeble man, rolled over by the agreement to give away the Sudetenland. And you mentioned just there in your answer about Neville Chamberlain, right up until the very end, thought that he could negotiate with Hitler. At the same time, within Great Britain, it was a house divided because you had a camp led by Winston Churchill, who later became the prime minister, that was saying, don't trust Hitler as far as you can throw him. You know, there's nothing there to be trusted. So there was a whole camp within Great Britain that was saying, watch out for this guy. He is trouble. How come Chamberlain wasn't listening to some of these other advisors who were giving him the advice to move away from Hitler sooner than he did?
Well, no, he did realize what the limits of talking with Hitler, and he realized that really quite early in 1939. And there isn't really a lobby saying, you know, let's go to war with Hitler. I mean, everybody in Britain, Churchill included, of course, would have preferred not to have a world war. Nobody, of course, you know, actually wants to plunge a democracy into world war. But there had come a point, I think, where for Chamberlain and for others, the world was clearly in crisis in the Far East, in the Mediterranean, the threat from the Soviet Union, the threat from Hitler. What did you do? And I think there's a point at which Chamberlain, like many other British people in 1939, suddenly said to themselves, there's nothing we can do about this. The only way we can get out of this in the end will be to wage a war. After that, then we'll rebuild a new Europe. We'll have a new order. We'll defeat fascism, and we'll start again. And I think that unlike Germany, in Britain, there is a much stronger sense in 39 that war is something which has got to be waged. It's a sense, I think, that Chamberlain and others had to come round to. It's a sense that many ordinary British people had as well.
Interesting. Now, you've just reversed my whole view of the two countries at that time. Great Britain taking the more realistic approach that war has to be waged, actually becoming the aggressor, or at least the warmonger, and Germany, the average person in the street, probably not wanting to get involved in war. Very, very interesting. We're talking to Richard Overy, everybody. His book, 1939 Countdown to War, recounts the last weeks leading right up to the beginning of World War II. And Richard, I'm going to ask you about the Soviet-German non-aggression pact that Hitler signed, actually von Ribbentrop signed it with Molotov. What role did the German-Soviet non-aggression pact play in the outbreak of World War II? Did it have any difference? Make any difference at all?
Well, I think actually it made war more certain, actually, because Hitler thought, of course, that this was a pact which would finally confront the British and the French with a fait accompli. Nothing they could do now. Germany could do what it wanted to do in Poland, and they couldn't appeal to the Soviet Union. He expected their governments to be overthrown. He thought it would be a green light for him to go on and do what he wanted to do in Central Europe. Now, that didn't happen. The British and the French disregarded it. They'd never trusted the Soviets anyway, and just assumed that all dictators were as bad as each other. And in fact, it made them more determined after the pact to confront Hitler and to make him back down, rather than less determined. But for Hitler, there was always this sense that the British Mensch must understand that there was nothing they could do for Poland. Now, he had an agreement with the Soviet Union. What could Britain and France do? Nothing. And the Soviet Union and Germany divided Poland between them in September 1939. So he was, in that sense, rational. I mean, it seemed to him quite rational that Britain and France shouldn't intervene. There was nothing they could do. But Britain and France didn't intervene really over Poland. They intervened because they realized that unless they stopped Hitler, unless they confronted him, this would represent the end of European civilization.
Well, now that's an interesting point, Richard, too, because if Britain and France are going to intervene to stop Hitler, then how did we get to the debacle of Dunkirk, where we're pulling the British troops out in what turned out to be a very, very difficult retreat back to Great Britain? If we were going to stop them right then and there, how come the British and the French forces weren't better prepared to meet Hitler and confront him?
Yes, I mean, they were not as well prepared as they might have been, but it's a myth that they were unprepared. In fact, Allied forces in May 1940 were, if anything, stronger on paper than the Germans they opposed. The problem was military incompetence, poor strategic grasp, a failure to understand how to use air power, and lots of, in other words, lots of military explanations why it went wrong. But the idea was to keep Germany bottled up for 3 years. The British and French war plan in 1939 was more or less a repeat of the First World War. Bottle Germany up, have a fixed line down the middle of Europe, bomb German cities, blockade Germany, deny it access to food and raw materials and so on, and then eventually you could march in and Germany would surrender. An incredibly naive strategic view. And it was completely undone, of course, by German military competence.
Yes, yes, it was. We're talking to Richard Over. Everybody, his book is 1939, Countdown to War. Now, Richard, I'm going to ask you to give an opinion or comment on something that one of your American cousins over here said. Pat Buchanan is on record. It's his opinion that World War II was an unnecessary war. That's what he said. What is your comment to that? Was he right? Was he wrong? Does he even know what he's talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I've read Pat Buchanan's book. In fact, I've debated with him last year. And, I mean, I think that what he's really saying is what I think quite a number of other people have said. You know, it would have been better in the end if Hitler and Stalin had fought it out and the West had, you know, managed to stand on the sidelines. This might have, you know, avoided all the catastrophes of the Second World War and so on and so on. But I think that's so much wishful thinking. I mean, some kind of crisis in Europe was inevitable. But what I think is important is that Britain and France decided at that point that there were values about Western civilization which had to be defended. Wherever they looked, and I don't mean the United States now, but wherever they looked, whether they looked in Japan, whether they looked in Mediterranean, Mussolini, whether they looked at the Soviet Union, whether they looked at Germany, what they saw was systems that wanted to undermine or destroy the existing Western legacy. And what Britain and France had to do, really, was to say, well, either we defend these or we give them up. I think Pat Buchanan doesn't recognize that sufficiently.
Hmm. Yes, he has a rather naive approach to it, and I would agree with you. We're talking to Richard Overy, everybody. Richard, let's bring the lessons of the last weeks of August in 1939 up to the present. Are there any lessons that we can take away from August 1939 that apply to today?
Well, I think there's a very important lesson. Excuse me. A very important lesson. There's a lesson, too, which you can see in the crisis of August 1914, too, with the outbreak of the First World War. And that is something that struck me when I worked on this week. It is how easy it is for politicians and military leaders. They're tired. They're rushing here and there. It's difficult to make a decision. They go from one meeting to another. They become increasingly locked into what I call a kind of mental box, which they find it very difficult to think outside. And I think the closer you get to a point of crisis, the more your options narrow down. And it does seem to me that the important thing at moments of crisis, whether it's the Cuban Missile Crisis or whether it's Iraq, the important thing is to recognize that there is this moment of crisis, that the mental box narrows, and to make sure that you've got enough people on hand to say, hang on, let's think about this. What other options are there? What other possibilities are there? So think outside that mental box, if you like.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, if there's one lesson, that's one lesson I'd like to see people learn.
And that is a good lesson to learn for anybody, whether you're in politics or whether you're in business. It applies equally well to both. We're talking to Richard Overy, everybody, author of the book 1939, Countdown to War. Richard, I alluded to this earlier. I wanted to play a little what if in history, because historians love to do this. So what if Neville Chamberlain was more like Winston Churchill, at least in his views towards Germany, that Germany was bad and needed to be stopped early on? And what if Winston Churchill was then prime minister at that point in history? How would things have played out differently than they did?
Well, it is a what if, which is very difficult to speculate. The British had armed heavily in 1936 and said to Hitler, you know, if you do anything else, we're going to invade you. That would certainly made Hitler think twice. But that was never a possibility for Britain. There were so many things limiting the possibility of British military intervention in Europe. Popular opinion would never have accepted it, and certainly would never have accepted Churchill as Prime Minister in the late 1930s. If Churchill had been there, well, what would have happened? I mean, we've been brought up on the idea that Chamberlain is this rather feeble weakling, and that Churchill is the man to stand up to Hitler. But I'm not sure if Churchill had been Prime Minister in the 1930s, what room for manoeuvre he would have had. He would have found it difficult to bring the British public into, you know, to accept the idea of seriously Hitler would have taken it either.
Very interesting.
What if?
It's
very difficult. Once you turn the dial, other things happen too. And you can't be certain that what you'd like to happen, that Churchill is a powerful leader, but Hitler is deterred, would actually have happened.
All right. We're talking to Richard Overy, everybody, author of the book 1939. Richard, you really focused in on a very narrow period of time leading into World War II. I'm going to ask you to sort of pan back out and look at the war in a bigger sense, because you've written other books on famous battles in the war, famous conflicts, and so forth. In your opinion, what is the most important battle for the European theater during World War II?
Well, I've always pointed to the Battle of Kursk in Russia in 1943, July 1943. It's the point at which the Red Army finally managed to defend themselves against the German attack in the summer weather, and not only to defend themselves, but to roll the German army back hundreds of miles and to inflict the heaviest defeat on them in the field that they'd yet experienced. And to me, that really is a critical turning point. If the Russians have got it wrong, and German forces have won the Battle of Kursk, then the Eastern Front might have unraveled in a very different way. And whatever happened in the Mediterranean and so on, you know, a German victory over the Soviet Union would mean 200 German divisions on the French coast and not 50.
Right, and it may have turned the tide of Normandy and everything else. Let me just take the other side of that coin and say that the most important battle in the European theater for World War II had to have been the Battle of the Atlantic. Not as many lives were lost, but certainly much more important to the salvation of Europe than even the tank battle at Kursk was, which was also a very big turning point.
Yes.
All right. Richard, you've been a great guest. Thank you so much for being here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. Enjoyed your book. The book is 1939, Countdown to War. The author, Richard Overy, a great historian and a wonderful radio guest. Thanks, Richard. We'll be talking to you down the line.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye.